This is the Simon Dell Show, where we take a deep dive into some of the week's most notable business and marketing stories and interview high-performing business leaders and marketing professionals to find out their lessons for success.
They actually thought that I was a freaking corporate spy. 95% of e-commerce is what you would call an average e-commerce site. Immediately make me understand what you do and why you're different than the rest. If I'm the right audience, then maybe you have me hooked.
Welcome to another edition of the Simon Dell Show, and thank you very much for joining us again this week. Now, we have a bit of an e-commerce-focused episode this week with a gentleman in LA by the name of Rafael Romes, who is a web developer who focuses specifically on e-commerce and beauty and fashion brands. So if you're in that space, this is definitely a must listen for you. If you're not in that space, it's still really interesting because some of the things he has to say apply to all sorts of industries and all sorts of platforms. So please don't go away. Please listen. So he'll be coming up in a minute. Other than that, if you want to get in contact with me, simondell.com is the website. Simon@simondell.com is the email. Instagram, the Simon Dell, or the Simon Dell Show. No, it's not the Simon Dell Show anymore. It's simondell.com. I'm on Instagram, myself, LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, but everywhere. I'm literally everywhere. I'm like God, but not quite as benevolent. So anyway, and finally, the other thing, yes, rate and review us on iTunes. As we said in the last couple of episodes, I somehow managed to lose all of our ratings and reviews, which is very, very stupid of me. So if you could go back on and do a rating, that would be fantastic. Otherwise, without any further ado, please enjoy the interview with Rafael Romes in LA talking about e-commerce. I'm joined today by Rafael Romes, which has the best name that we've had so far on this show. And he is based in LA. So unfortunately, not the first American that we've had on the show. You are second. So unfortunately, break our American cherry, pop our American cherry. But welcome to the show. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
And you said to me you're in Brentwood. So if anybody who knows or doesn't know LA, tell us, explain whereabouts Brentwood is in LA.
Brentwood is, so there is East LA, which is the downtown area. And then there is West LA, which is the beach area, where you have Santa Monica and Venice. Nice. Brentwood is right next to the Santa Monica part. So that's where you want to be.
And how far away are you from the beach? I think that's the question that we all need to know.
Not far at all. It's like a 5 or 10 minute drive.
Nice. Weather good there today?
Yeah, the weather has been pretty great.
Cool. Now, the first thing that kind of jumped out that I wanted to ask you about is you've kind of lived in a few different places, haven't you? You've been about a bit. So where did you, I noticed that you've worked in, obviously you're in LA, but did you do some time in the UK as well?
I did. So I was born and raised in Greece.
Okay.
Then when I turned 17 and a half, I went to England to study.
Right.
In Canterbury, which is about an hour away from London.
My parents happen to live in Tunbridge Wells.
So oh, no way.
Canterbury very well, yes.
Look at that.
Yes.
And then after I got my bachelor's out there in Canterbury, I went to London because I had to find a job. And the way it works in England is that you can apply for your job by telling them the grade that you got on your degree.
Yep.
Or by telling them your predicted grade, so the grade that you expect to get.
So did you tell them your actual grade or your predicted
grade? My predicted grade, because I knew that...
did your predicted grade turn into your actual grade?
Not at all. So basically, it was a situation where I knew that if I wait and I get my actual grade, yep, I'm kind of screwed. Because not that it was a horrible grade or anything, but it's one of those things where everybody wants the A student. So if you have a B, yeah, It's like a nef. It doesn't even matter.
Yeah. So what did you start doing once you got that job? What was that first job that you had there in London?
Well, the actual first job I had was for a betting company.
Yeah.
I did that during the summer of my first or second year of studies. And then the first quote unquote real job that I had was for a pharmaceutical company out in London.
Okay. What got you into that? How did you, was that just something that was available or?
It was literally circumstance. So what happened is, back to what I was saying, I could not apply online to get a nice job. Pardon me, because the grades that I had were not top notch. So I basically just traveled to London before I even got my degree. And I started going to job trade shows, essentially.
Yeah.
And I would go up to the hiring person and I would say, if I apply online, you're just going to see me on paper. I'll look like everybody else. But you have me right in front of you. And I'm telling you that if you don't hire me, you'll be missing out on the best opportunity. Now, thinking back to it right now, I'm like, holy shit, did I really do that? But yeah, I did. And it worked.
Yeah, so great sales pitch. Great sales pitch.
Yeah, it worked.
And I guess that's something that's a common theme about a lot of the people that I talk to on the show is that they've got some a great background in sales and being able to sell things, and that really helps them later on in their careers.
Absolutely. I would say that my biggest skill is not necessarily selling, but knowing how to work with people and understanding their needs and presenting things. And anything that I've done in life was done because of that one skill.
Yeah. You found your way to explain to me how you got from London to LA. What was the sort of pattern of circumstances that did that?
So that is a very long story that I'll sum up.
I was going to say we may not have long enough, but that's,
you might not.
If we could do a sort of slightly shorter version, but yes.
So basically, straight out of school on my last year, right before I got my degree, I went out to different job trade shows in London, and that's how I landed my job in the pharmaceutical company. The way that it worked in the pharmaceutical company is that you start with essentially what would be a trial period where they have you for, they're still paying you and everything, but you have a certain goal of what you need to do within the first 3 months of employment. And then if you hit the goal, you continue working. I did about 3 times the goal within my second month. So it was really exciting and everything. But, and that's where I'm cutting the story short, they actually thought that I was a freaking corporate spy. So,
right, okay.
My 21-year-old self that just graduated college somehow was recruited to become a corporate spy. So,
right.
There was a little bit of conflict there, which I didn't appreciate. And so I decided to quit the job, go back to Greece, and try to figure out what I want to do. And that's how I left England.
Yeah.
Back in Greece, I actually opened a retail store for about a year. But what I like to say is that Greece is the best place for vacation. England is a great place for work. The US, specifically Los Angeles, is a perfect balance. Yeah. So what happened in Greece is that I just was not working. I was just enjoying myself. And I was too old to just be enjoying myself. I needed to make some money. And that's why I wanted to leave Greece again. And I had already done England. So I thought, might as well try America.
Was it how hard was it to get into the US back then? I guess this was back in
2007-ish.
Yeah,
maybe more. 2006.
So as presumably you had Greek nationality.
I did. Yeah, I do.
How hard was it to get into the US and start working there?
It worked out for me because I wasn't planning to come out to the US and work right away. I wanted to see how I'm going to like it first. So I went to school. I actually went to film school.
Gotcha.
So I got the student visa. It was very easy for me to get in the country. And then I met my wife. So it ended up being easy to stay in the country as well.
Right.
If I hadn't met my wife, if I wasn't married, then that would have been a whole different ballgame. But that part worked out for me.
You've done quite a considerable time, probably close to 10 years now, in the online marketing space, either through just doing online marketing with a previous company, but also with your own web design company. Tell us a little bit about Weberus. How did you come up with that? What was your sort of motivation behind that? And why did you want to do it?
So it's not very romantic. So essentially the motivation was I had to make money. That's what it was.
Yeah.
But the backstory, which might be interesting, is that it started because of a failed business. So I didn't set out to create a web design and development agency. I actually started because I bought a bunch of domain names.
Okay.
And then I thought that if I buy them, I can sell them and make money. Why? Because I saw a couple of people that were able to sell domain names for a lot of money. So I thought, that looks easy. So fast forward to a couple of months of doing the domain buying, I realized that I had basically spent all my savings buying domains that was crap. I would never be able to sell any of them. I essentially wanted to find a way to cut my losses. So that's when I found about AdSense. Are you familiar with Google AdSense?
Yes, absolutely.
So I realized that I could make a very simple blog and put some ads from Google on it. And then Google would give me a small percentage of any clicks that happen on those ads.
Yeah.
And I did it without knowing anything. I didn't know how to make a website. I just figured I just would create a simple WordPress blog. And surely enough, I started getting a couple of clicks. Nothing major, but imagine from every domain name, I was making maybe about $1 a month. And that was enough to actually help me break even with a bunch of those. And it was also enough to get me interested in how do I make this better and bigger. So that's how I started learning how to build websites. I started learning how to do SEO and rank higher on Google and all of that good stuff.
What are you building these days? What sort of stuff are you working on? What sort of projects?
These days, we're actually focusing on e-commerce and more specifically beauty and fashion. So we build more robust websites. It's been a long journey where it started with simple blogs. Then that didn't work out because Google decided that they're not very into that. And that's how I started Weberus. And then I started Weberus as a one-man show that then grew to, we have about 15 people today. And we build really robust websites where we talk about strategy. We really create an efficient user flow to enhance conversions. And all of our websites are custom built, tailored to the brand that they're meant to serve and for the audience that they're targeting.
What are you building in? What sort of content management systems?
It's either WordPress for informational websites or Shopify for e-commerce.
Okay. How do you find Shopify? I mean, I guess there's a lot of people out there that are looking at e-commerce. Do you think it's if you had a choice and you talk to a new customer, what's your preference, WordPress or the Shopify?
For e-commerce, hands down Shopify.
Okay.
I would actually say Shopify versus any platform in terms of e-commerce because they created a really amazing platform where they give you a lot of scalability Like, we have clients that are doing millions and millions of sales and are getting hundreds of thousands of traffic, and the site never slows down. Whereas you look at Magento, or even Demandware in some cases, and and they have issues with traffic spikes, where Shopify doesn't. So I would say super user-friendly, very affordable. Everything checks out for Shopify.
How customizable is it? I mean, obviously, you know, when you start talking about WordPress and Magento as e-commerce platforms, you find a good developer and they can make these kind of websites do absolutely anything. Does Shopify have limits in terms of its customizability?
It used to. I would say not so much anymore. Because they created an API that's very robust. And so, just like you said, if you find a good developer, they can most likely do pretty much anything. Maybe there's going to be that 0.1% of things that might be a little bit more difficult to do, but you'd still be able to do them. So that's what I like about.
And I guess in fashion and beauty brands, there's probably not a whole lot of complexity in terms of what they're offering. It's fairly... I don't want to use the word standard, but they're fairly consistent in terms of how they're presented.
It depends. I would say that in general, 90-95% of e-commerce is what you would call an average e-commerce site, regardless of the industry. But then there's always the brands that want to stand out. They want to do something different. Maybe they want to create a community around their product. And that's where it gets a little bit more complicated. And there's a lot of that in beauty, especially.
In all the sites that you've built over the years and where you work now in that sort of e-commerce space, what are some of the things that you see people, big e-commerce sites doing wrong? You know, where you would, if you walked in and just said, you know, here's some instant things that you guys can do better, what would they be?
The number one thing would be, I mean, I can give you things for the bigger brands and I can give you things for the smaller brands.
Just,
or things,
you know,
that
absolutely,
apply to
either
brands
or, just,
across,
you know,
the
just
board.
Just general things that, you know, that irrespective of people are looking at their sites.
So the number one thing I would say is that a lot of companies become companies out of just thinking that they have a good product at a good price.
Right.
And so they launch a store and they hope to make sales. So sometimes you'll see that there is someone that doesn't really have any kind of unique positioning. And they work really, really hard. And they sometimes manage to make a few sales. And then they're thinking, you know, why am I not converting more? Why am I not getting repeat customers? Things like that. And the answer is that they don't focus on what it is that makes them stand out. And we see this all the time, small or large.
Give me an example about how you would fix that kind of thing. Is there a sort of case study? You don't have to name them, but, you know, something that's...
There is a bunch. So you have, a good example is Melt Cosmetics. That's one of our clients. They were two makeup artists that worked in Nordstrom, which is a big department store in the US. And, they wanted to launch a lipstick line. But it wasn't just a lipstick line. They specifically wanted highly pigmented colors. So colors that really, really stand out. They're very bright or very bold. Yeah. So they put this together and then they started getting a bunch of pictures of themselves, of their customers, and posting them on social media. And that's how they started creating a buzz. So it wasn't just we're launching a new lipstick line. It was that we're launching a lipstick line with very, very bold colors, like colors that you've never seen before. And based on that, they launched their website or relaunched their website, and they actually sold out in under an hour.
Wow.
And that was at midnight. Yeah. So imagine that they sold out between midnight and 1 a.m.
So... okay, so I guess that was probably a bit of a surprise for them when that happened.
For sure, for sure. But I think the takeaway of that is that when you launch a product, when you launch a brand, don't focus on the literal specs of your product, because people don't really, in reality, they don't really care about that. What they care about is how your product makes them feel, or they want to feel special after buying your product or using your service. And I think that the same applies in pretty much every single industry. So I hate it when I see, when I go to a website and within the first few seconds, it looks like it could be any website, if that makes sense. So for example, I come to your website, you sell cosmetics, and all I see is packaging of different creams or different makeup items. That could be anything. But now if you give me a tagline, if you give me a small paragraph, if you give me something more, that will immediately make me understand what you do and why you're different than the rest, then if I'm the right audience, then maybe you have me hooked. Yeah. And maybe I'm going to want to look more into your products. And there's so many examples here. Like, for example, look at Pura Vida bracelets. Okay. Super successful. They're just two bracelets. If you look at them, they look very cute, but it's not like a super unique bracelet. But they're all about giving back. All the bracelets are made in Costa Rica by locals. They have no other job. And so they created jobs for Costa Rica and they give back to Costa Rica. Yeah. So when they launched their brand, it was all about Costa Rica.
Yeah.
They happen to sell bracelets, that's their product, but it wasn't about the bracelets. They weren't saying, this is the most amazing bracelet you've ever seen, because there's no such thing, right? But instead, by making it about something else, something that's bigger, they created a following. And the same is true by looking at pretty much every really, really big success. You're going to see this happening over and over again.
Is there... I know this is going to sound a stupid question because I know what the answer is going to be, but how important is the visual element of what's online to actually translating into a sale? Like the images and, the pictures of the products.
Oh, yeah. I was going to try to answer in a different way by saying that sometimes you can work around it, but no, you really can't. I oftentimes tell my clients, So we're a higher-end agency. We have a lot of big successes. And so we get a ton of people, especially from beauty and fashion, coming to us to work with us. And I oftentimes tell them that if your budget is only enough to cover our payment, do not work with us. Because if you don't have money to get me good photography, your website is going to look like shit. That's the end of story. Like, it's never going to work. You're going to look like a very cheap brand that doesn't really have credibility if you don't get me good photography, no matter what I do with the website. Yeah. So it's super important.
And what about video in that as well? Is that, we probably all know the answer to this, but... I think we know video is useful. What type of video? What would you, if they have unlimited budget, what would you be advising people in terms of video on an e-commerce site?
User generated.
Right. Okay.
I would advise them to put all their money on creating a following and getting their followers to create video, because video can be so powerful. Yep. We work with several brands that sell out mainly because of video and social media. But what's really, really powerful here is stories, right? Using other people and having other people selling your product rather than you trying to sell your product.
Yeah.
So I think that, and we're going to see a lot more of that. It's already obviously happening. It's the thing of the past couple of years with the influencers. But one thing that I think we're going to see a lot more of is micro-influencers.
Yeah, there's been quite a lot about... Explain to everyone what a micro-influencer is.
I actually wrote an article about this on Forbes. It went out, I believe, about a month ago. And there's a lot of debate, interestingly enough, about the actual numbers. So I'm not even going to get into the numbers, number of followers. But let's just say that a micro-influencer is any kind of person that has a small audience, right, like maybe a few thousand followers. It's enough to actually matter. It's enough to drive some sales, but it's not enough to be like a game changer.
Yeah.
So you're not going to base a campaign on a micro-influencer. But, and that was the argument in that article, instead of investing $1 million on getting the mega influencer, the really big celebrity with millions of followers, you're much better off investing the same amount or less money and getting a bunch of micro influencers, because the person that only has a few thousand followers and is very specific about one thing, their audience will typically engage a lot more.
Okay.
If they say something, they're going to listen, versus when you look at Kim Kardashian, she has millions and millions of followers. And so a lot of people just follow because she's Kim Kardashian,
yeah,
right? It doesn't mean that they're going to follow her every word. So that's a big distinction here. The essentially, number of followers does not necessarily equal more sales.
Okay. All right. What one other question I have from an e-commerce perspective is checkout and payment. What are people expecting these days from a payment? Are they obviously they want something quick and easy, but do people sort of still gravitate to PayPal or dislike PayPal? Do they want to use certain other transactional gateways? What do you find is the trust factor when it comes to, you know, e-commerce and payments?
I think the typical credit card is the most used system. But what we're noticing is that depending on the industry, you're going to see different people using PayPal.
Yeah.
So, for example, when you're dealing with potentially collectible items, that's when you see a lot more PayPal. And the reason you see a lot more PayPal is that you get a lot of international buyers that maybe will not be able to pay through different means.
Gotcha.
One payment method that is definitely picking up and might end up potentially becoming the winner is Amazon payments.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. Because you have everything set up.
Yeah.
You just plug in and you're good to go.
And you've already got your credit cards already stored with Amazon and that's interesting. There's again, this might just be an Australia centric question, but I don't know whether the US would have things like called Afterpay and stuff like that, where you can you pay for something, but you pay for it in say four blocks in, you know, 4 weeks or 4 months after, you know, you've bought the product.
Yes, we do. It's not super common. It depends on the type of product, like everything.
Yeah.
The higher the price, the more of that you see.
Yeah.
I think it's becoming a little bit more common. We're getting, like, I'll put this into perspective. We built probably a couple of hundred websites.
Yeah.
And we've only used a payment solution like Afterpay a handful of times.
Okay.
Like maybe four or five.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is that in the last year, we've gotten a handful of requests specifically looking for that.
I think it's something that's becoming a lot more prolific now.
I agree.
It's one of those areas that I actually think Australia is, and a lot of people mention this, is a long way ahead of America in terms of payment systems and the way that you use credit cards in stores and things like that. You know, nobody kind of swipes credit cards anymore. It's just a pay wave thing where you just wave the credit card at a machine and that's and you walk off. You know, people don't sign for things anymore.
Totally.
You know, so that's changed quite considerably. The other area that I wanted to touch on with e-commerce, and you mentioned the brand being a really important factor with e-commerce, is the delivery and the way that people receive things and the manner in which things are packed and sealed. Do you think that matters? Do you think that's or people just don't care if it just rocks up in any old box? Do they want that showmanship of a brand product arriving, or do they just want it in a box?
I think that it really comes down to prioritizing. So if you ask me, do they care? For sure. I've seen brands that have done this really, really well. I would say Warby Parker is one of them.
Yep.
The product is so affordable, and yet their packaging is pretty sharp. It looks great. So when you receive that after you place your order, to receive a package that is very nicely put together makes you feel really good about your purchase, which means that you have a much better chance of coming back and making another purchase. Yep. So it definitely matters. Would I put it at the top of the list? Probably not, only because it comes after the conversion.
Yeah.
So unless if you use it as part of your conversion, unless if you tell them, order this, and this is what you're going to get. You're going to get this beautiful box with that other little box inside it and a handwritten thank you note and all that. And so it becomes part of why you would want to buy this product.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Social media aside and influencers aside, and I think we all know how important those channels are for certain e-commerce brands, how important is email and e-newsletters and EDMs, whatever you want to call them, how important is that now to an e-commerce brand? Is it still important, or is it something that people shouldn't spend too much time on?
I think that if used properly, then I guess that's a bullshit answer, right? If you did right, then you can do well. But it's kind of true, though. Like, what I mean to say by that is, even before we go into newsletters, think about a blog. People call us all the time and say, should we have a blog? And the answer is, if you're going to have a blog that you're going to be like, oh, I don't want to post on this, or I'll just copy and paste an article that I found somewhere else, things like that, it's not going to work. In fact, it might make you look really bad. But if you're going to create a robust blog with actual news that people want to read about, then it could potentially become a huge business driver. Yeah. We've seen a lot of blogs that started as blogs and then turned into successful e-commerce sites because they created amazing content that people wanted to read. And so then if they love your content, they're much more inclined to buy something from you.
Yeah.
Same idea with emails. I think that if you're going to have a newsletter, don't make it be just about yourself and your products. If you just send like once a month or once every 2 weeks, you send an email saying, hey, here are new products.
Yeah.
Screw that. You know, who wants to read that? Unless if I'm like a diehard fan that wants to learn about all your products, I don't care about that. Mm-hmm. But give me something else that I care about. Give me a piece of news. Tell me that somebody that I follow, somebody that I care about, wore the product, and now I can also buy the same product, and then maybe I'll buy the same product.
Yeah.
But that's a lot of it comes down to that. So I would say that you cannot give a blanket answer. I will say that, hell yeah, you should do it, because it can make a huge difference to your business. We've seen businesses that grew by 20 or 30%, established businesses. So like a couple of million dollars that came out of using marketing properly, using email marketing properly, and services like Klaviyo, for example, that give you like in-depth analytics of every.
I was going to say, is there any sort of tools out there, digital tools that you like to use,
definitely,
or that you prefer to use?
Definitely. So I would say, if you're going to do a basic newsletter, you want to keep things a little bit more affordable, you want to go with MailChimp. It's a very good user-friendly service. If you can afford to spend a little bit more, and if you're going to actually invest time, then you want to go with Klaviyo. Because Klaviyo is going to give you a lot more in-depth analytics. It's going to let you, follow the path that every recipient of the email took. And it will also let you target specific users individually. So it can be really, really powerful.
Yeah. Okay. Got final few questions for you today. what are some brands that you really like? And maybe I'm going to keep this because I normally ask this as a general question, but maybe keep this in the e-commerce space. Some brands that you that aren't clients of yours that you look at their e-commerce proposition and go, that's you know, really beautiful or really good, or you know, who's doing it well out there?
I love Warby Parker, that I mentioned before. I actually bought a pair of glasses from them too. I love them because they came up with an amazing value proposition, and then they also branded it so greatly. So I think everything about them is just so beautifully done, from getting you interested to get to inspiring trust to also actually delivering. Even though the quality is not going to be amazing, I don't think it's the best quality glasses I've ever gotten, but I felt very, very good about the purchase. And I think that that's so key about creating a successful e-commerce business.
And I think if for anybody who goes to look at it, warbyparker.com, that's warbyparker.com. As soon as land there, there's their try 5 frames for free offer on their website, which is, you know, which grabs you straight away. For anyone who sits there and goes, how do you get someone's attention, you know, from an e-commerce platform straight away? You've only got to look at that front page of that website to go, well, there's an idea straight away.
Exactly.
Are there any others that sort of jump out to you as well?
Sure. I really like Fenty Beauty.
Yep.
The reason I like them is that obviously they have Rihanna behind the brand. So that's as big of an influencer as you get.
Absolutely, yeah.
But unlike many other influencer-driven brands that simply count on that influencer to bring sales, Fenty Beauty created what I like to call the unicorn principle, which is essentially when you have something special, something that makes you stand out and that your audience cares about, if you use it consistently across the board on your website, your social, etc., then you'll make a ton of sales. And for Fenty Beauty, that's the fact that they created makeup specifically for different skin tones. So it's not, you know, for all the different colors out there, they created makeup that looks great. Yeah. And that's what they keep showing. That's why they have all different nationalities, all different skin colors, all over the place.
Yeah.
It's never like a consistent one look. They always try to show that they have the variety.
Second to last question, what is next for you? The project that you're working on at the moment, the that sort of generate culture is mm-hmm. fairly new. What's your plans for that for the rest of this year and next year?
So what happened is that as Weber's grew as a company and the more people we started hiring, I turned from being a strategist, which is what I love, to being a manager, which is not what I like. And I'm not a very good manager to that. So that's why I wanted to launch Generate Culture, and that's why I wanted to start focusing on beauty brands, beauty and fashion, I would say.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what's in store for me for the rest of the year and next year. I would basically personally focus on just a handful of brands where I would strategize with them the same way that a consultant would. But I would also use my resources through Weber's in order to execute. So I like to say that I bring the best of both worlds, where a consultant will give you personal attention, but then they lack the execution. And then an agency has the resources to execute, but a lot of times you get lost into the like a very process-driven situation. So I take the best of both and I bring it into one.
Yeah. Okay. Fantastic. And if people want to get hold of you, if people have got a question in terms of e-commerce or, you know, just, you know, in any kind of digital space, what's the best way of them finding you?
Social media. Hit me up on Instagram. It's Rafael Romis, @RafaelRomis.
Cool. Awesome. And you're on LinkedIn as well. Any other platforms that you use?
I could say that I use Facebook, but then I'd be lying. So I have a Facebook page, but I almost never check it. So I would say LinkedIn, I definitely check a lot, and Instagram too. Instagram is kind of like
Do you think Facebook is waning in terms of its influence and popularity?
I think Facebook is great for... Facebook is amazing. We've seen brands built upon Facebook, and more specifically Facebook ads. So
yeah,
I think it's a great platform. Just personally for me, I just never really got into it, if I'm being honest. Yeah.
Fair enough. Mate, look, thank you very much for your time today. It's been really insightful. And I think anybody out there who's running an e-commerce business or is thinking about running an e-commerce business needs to listen to what you've got to say and read some of the stuff that you've put out there. So, mate, really appreciate your time today, and hopefully we'll catch up again with you soon.
Excellent. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you very much once again for tuning into the Simon Dell Show. It was fantastic to have you with us. Once again, if you'd like to get in contact with me, come and find me at simondell.com. Otherwise, please rate and review us on iTunes, and we will see you next week.